Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Supply-side economics is back. The new GOP budget proposal seems to be based on the idea that less taxation will bring in lots more money. Today, we'll take a closer look at both sides of that ongoing debate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you join us this Wednesday, April 6th. Budget negotiations to avoid a government shutdown at midnight Friday remain stalemated for yet another day. President Obama warned today a shutdown would harm the economy's fragile recovery. Meanwhile, people are looking more closely at the longer-term roadmap for deficit reduction released yesterday by House Republicans. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the Republican budget for 2012 includes some rather rosy economic assumptions.
House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan said it yesterday, and we played it. Here it is again.
If you tax something more, you get less of it. If you tax something less, you get more of it. We don't want to tax jobs more. We want them to be taxed less so we can get more of them.
Ryan's budget predicts less government spending and less taxation will drastically shrink unemployment, rejuvenate the housing market, and generate billions in extra government revenue. That forecast comes from the Conservative Heritage Foundation, which adheres to Ronald Reagan's supply-side economics. Get the government out of the way, and the economy will flourish.
I think it is an optimistic analysis of what is likely to happen.
The Tax Policy Center's Howard Gleckman says less borrowing definitely helps the economy. As for smaller government,
that's a much more theological question, and I don't think there's a clear answer to it.
The Bush tax cuts in 2001 didn't generate the millions of new jobs supply-siders predicted, but liberal stimulus programs don't always work either. And the Urban Institute's Eugene Sterley says now is a dangerous time to experiment with either extreme, given huge deficits.
Neither one is going to be able, I think, anymore to argue that just cutting taxes that raise deficits are good or that increasing spending and raising deficits is good. That's part of the reason we're in the trap we're in.
He says the growing view here is that both higher taxes and smaller government will be needed to spring that trap. And that's just what the last few deficit review commissions have been saying. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Back to the pressing matter of a government shutdown by week's end. That could coincide with Tax Day, which this year, for all you procrastinators, falls on Monday, April 18th. Now, in a shutdown, lots of federal workers get furloughed, and yes, that includes the IRS. As the budget stalemate continues, we wondered, is the tax man an essential employee? From Washington Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Thomas Cook teaches tax law at Georgetown University. He says that if the government shuts down, so does the IRS.
I will tell you, this couldn't happen at a worst possible time.
Taxpayers routinely rely on the IRS to answer their questions and give them advice.
Your ability to get some help, either on the telephone or in person face-to-face, will be seriously limited.
And what about refunds? This morning, the White House said taxpayers who file forms electronically probably would get them on time. But what about everyone else?
I would certainly not recommend preparing tax returns by hand.
That's Patricia Thompson, a CPA in Providence, Rhode Island. She says the advantage to using e-file is it checks to make sure your Social Security number's right and your numbers add up. Electronic filing has become the new norm, according to the IRS. Almost 100 million taxpayers used e-file last year.
And if there are any issues based on its internal checking, then it's going to be bounced and a notice will go out. Or it could even be rejected before it's accepted.
Thomas Cook says the last few months have been frustrating. Congress waited until the 11th hour to decide what to do with the so-called Bush-era tax cuts. While they debated, the IRS couldn't even print forms.
This was a nightmare. I could never, at any point during the fall semester, tell the students what the law was, affirmatively, for that very year.
Professor Cook may be changing his syllabus again. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street usually hates uncertainty, but investors seem to be taking a wait-and-see approach to this government stalemate, and stocks inched ahead today. Details when we do the numbers.
We keep hearing about how much we can't afford and what programs we need to cut to rein in the federal deficit. But there could be two edges to the budget knife. Commentator Robert Reich wonders why one agenda item seems to be missing from the conversation.
As Americans get ready to file their taxes, politicians are battling over how much to cut government spending in order to reduce huge deficits. Curiously, though, one option for deficit reduction seems to be off the table. That's to raise taxes on the very rich. For decades now, America's top earners have been pulling in a larger and larger share of the nation's total income. Over the same period, though, their tax rates have steadily declined. In the 1950s, the top marginal income tax rate was 91%. Now it's 35%. Even when you include deductions and credits, the super rich are now paying a far lower portion of their incomes in taxes than at any time since World War II. Meanwhile, capital gains and dividends, a big chunk of their income, were taxed at 35% as recently as the late 1980s. Now they're taxed at 15%. And the estate tax has now vanished for estates under $5 million, or $10 million a couple. If the rich were taxed at the same rates they were taxed a half century ago, they'd be paying some $350 billion more this year in federal taxes. That would be trillions of dollars over the next decade, a major contribution to eliminating the deficit. Now, yes, of course, clever accountants and tax lawyers would find ways around any tax increases, but this was always the case. The real difference between now and then is the political power of the super rich is much greater. After all, that's why their tax rates are so much lower. But it's just possible that the devastating budget squeezes in Washington and in state capitals, and the slashing of public services vital to the middle class and the poor, may prompt Americans to look back 50 years and ask why the super rich shouldn't pay the same tax rates now as they did then.
Robert Reich was Labor Secretary for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, David Frum. And in the meantime, you can always throw your two cents into the budget debate at marketplace.org. Warren Buffett stunned the investment world last week when he announced one of his top executives was leaving Berkshire Hathaway. David Sokol had been one of a handful of likely successors to Buffett. But there was some other news in that press release. Sokol had bought $10 million worth of shares in a chemical company called Lubrizol, which, as it happened, he then suggested that Berkshire Hathaway should buy. In today's Wall Street Journal, Leslie Sism and her colleagues report that Buffett has long had a policy in place against trading in companies in which his company might invest. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Let's go back a little. When Sokol's departure was announced, what did Buffett have to say about it?
First, Warren had a lot of very complimentary things to say about Dave. He said that Dave's contributions have been extraordinary. He delivered a great performance as a manager. As for the transaction, the press release didn't mention that the company has a long-standing policy in place that seems to cover the kind of transaction Mr. Buffett described Dave Sokol as having made in the shares of Lubrizol.
But the implication there is that he was not happy about it.
This is clearly a very odd press release, and Warren Buffett opens the press release saying this press release will be unusual. Clearly, it was very carefully worded, but it left people scratching their heads. What exactly does Mr. Buffett think here? Some of the answers have come out as the Wall Street Journal got its hands on a copy of that internal policy. We could tell there was a different story going on in the company where the company was concerned about whether Mr. Sokol had violated the policy. That wasn't mentioned at all in this March 30th release, which has prompted an additional round of questions about how Mr. Buffett has handled all this.
You point out that there is a very specific rule here about company officials trading in firms in which Buffett might have an interest. Tell us more about those specifics.
In this policy, which we reviewed, there are several references to how the executives who are covered by this policy may not trade in any securities if they're in possession of material, non-public information about those stocks. There's a question as to whether the words material, non-public are at play in this particular transaction.
Now, Sokol made this investment a week before he suggested that Berkshire Hathaway buy this company. What has he himself had to say about this?
He has said that he made the decision to invest in Lubrizol using publicly available information, just whatever any other investor in America could get their hands on. And in fact, he had no way of knowing that even if he recommended the stock to Mr. Buffett, that Mr. Buffett would be interested or would proceed with the deal.
Now, the questions that are being raised about this, though, are all the more surprising because this is the Oracle of Omaha. Buffett has a reputation here. I mean, if this were a company without such a public face, do you think it would get this much attention?
No, I think you're exactly right. Few executives in corporate America are as revered as Mr. Buffett. He's a man known for his integrity as well as his investment acumen. So a lot of people are saying, how could this happen at his company?
So what's next in this case, and particularly for Warren Buffett?
Mr. Buffett really isn't saying much about this right now. He is expected to field a lot of questions on this when he holds Berkshire's annual meeting on April 30th. Buffett watchers are wondering if this will tarnish the legacy that he was hoping to leave behind for this very important insurance and industrial conglomerate.
Leslie Sism has been digging into this story for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
When Blockbuster Video went on the auction block this week, a lot of people were wondering, who would want to buy such a seemingly antiquated business teetering on liquidation? Turns out, Dish Network saw something on the plate. Early this morning, the satellite service agreed to buy Blockbuster in a bankruptcy court auction for $320 million. From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn takes a look at plans for the once-dominant movie rental business.
For half a decade now, Blockbuster has been a dead man walking in the movie business. Netflix destroyed it, first offering movie rentals through the mail and then streaming movies online. Meanwhile, Blockbuster was saddled with leases for thousands of increasingly deserted stores. So when news hit that the Dish Network was paying real money for Blockbuster, most analysts and reporters slapped their head and had the same thought. What in the world are they thinking? But Todd Mitchell at Kaufman Brothers believes this move is brilliant.
I think this could be a potentially a game changer. This is one of the most interesting things I've seen in a long time in the space.
Mitchell says Dish gets two big assets in this sale: Blockbuster's existing customer base, and the rights to stream thousands of movies online. And if it rolls that into a Dish Network subscription, he thinks the company could create a powerful competitor to take on Netflix.
It's possible for them to create a similar service.
Thomas Egan is at Collins Stewart. He says if Dish builds a streaming movie service,
the bulk of that will be created by the existing content deals they have through Blockbuster. The question is, will they be able to keep those going? And that's unclear.
Eventually, the Dish Network and Blockbuster will have to sign new studio deals. And buying the rights to stream movies online is getting much more expensive. Just this morning, Netflix paid $100 million for the rights to Mad Men. And Egan isn't convinced the Dish Network can generate the kind of cash it will need to compete. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, economic fluctuations always affect food prices.
Food is one of those things that just responds very quickly because everybody has to eat.
So why the discrepancies in what we're paying? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 32 points, or 0.25%, to close at 12,426. The Nasdaq added 8 points, 0.3%, to finish at 2799. The S&P 500 rose 2 points, that's 0.2%, to end the day at 1335. Cisco Systems led tech stocks after its CEO suggested in a memo to employees that the networking giant might narrow its business and cut costs. Investors cheered, sending Cisco shares nearly 5% higher. Dish Network shares were unchanged, but Netflix, the rival video business that Dish may be targeting, saw its shares lose 1.75%. Major European markets locked in gains before Portugal became the third country to seek an EU bailout. Britain's FTSE and Germany's DAX each tacked on 0.5%. France's CAC 40 rose more than 0.1%. Bond prices fell again. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.55%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ristall. Israel is pushing back on the idea of Palestinian statehood. Officials in Jerusalem said today that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will press his German counterparts in a meeting later this week to drop plans to endorse a Palestinian state. At the same time, the Palestinian economy has won a key endorsement from the International Monetary Fund. It concludes the Palestinian Authority has built the framework to conduct sound economic policies and supervise a banking system. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
With everything that's been going on in the Middle East lately, it's been easy to overlook the Palestinians. But the IMF has been on the ground, and it reports some economic progress. The IMF says the Palestinian Authority is ready to handle the economic side of statehood. It's managed its budgets and built credible institutions, such as the Palestine Monetary Authority, or PMA, which has taken on the role of central bank. George Abed ran the PMA from 2005 to 2007. In that job, he helped implement a lot of changes.
PMA has established its credentials as a very robust and efficient and effective institution in licensing and supervising banks and in maintaining good credit flow to the private sector.
The PMA can't do something else that central banks do, which is manage currency, because the Palestinian Authority doesn't have its own currency yet. The Palestinian economy grew 9% last year, but there are still big question marks, like high unemployment and Israeli controls on movement of people and goods. Edward Sayer is a professor of international development at the University of Southern Mississippi.
The ability to control its borders to determine the direction of trade is something that's critical for any geographic entity that wants to become a sovereign economic country.
When the UN General Assembly meets in September, the Palestinian Authority is hoping to win a resolution to be recognized as a state, and it hopes this IMF report will help. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. Time for your letters.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We'll start today with Facebook. Last week, commentator Rob Walker shared why he doesn't like the idea of a dislike button on Facebook. Many of you wrote in to share your dislike of his idea. Mike Collins from Frederick, Maryland says a dislike button would be useful.
I'd like to see one. Such a button would be appreciated when somebody posts news of the loss of a loved one, the death of a pet, or a diagnosis of cancer. Nobody wants to hit the like button for news like that.
Megan Cogswell of Salem, Oregon says, although Mr. Walker may think Facebook is superficial, it does provide an important tool for staying in touch.
I agree as a whole that Facebook is shallow and contrived, though I stay on because we have a huge family. When a family member was recently very ill, it gave a large number of people a way to stay in touch. Without Facebook, I might not know our niece was pregnant with twins yet. It's nice to be in the loop.
On our April 1st show, we couldn't pass up the opportunity to fool some of our listeners. Sally Herships reported a piece about advertisers putting their marketing right on food. Kyle Mayling from Yardley, Pennsylvania says, good job.
You had me until the very end, and I have to agree with everyone else who wrote in. It's way too realistic sounding.
I remember when CBS was going to market their lineup on chicken eggs, so this just isn't that far from reality.
It's not all Facebook and tomfoolery. Monday, we interviewed bank consultant Mike Mebs about Citibank's move to reduce the number of bounced checks their clients have by clearing smaller amounts first. Well, John Arthur from Austin, Texas, says banks should just leave things the way they are. Just process them in the order they come in, he suggests, but do it promptly so balances are current and people can keep up with things. Sounds like the way I balance my account moment to moment. We're always eager to check your thoughts. Go to our website, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. Unless maybe you've been living life on, the International Space Station, you're painfully aware that food prices keep rising around the globe. Corn futures have doubled in the last year. Here's the thing, though. That doesn't mean the cost of corn products is up twofold everywhere. Food inflation differs dramatically from country to country. But why the difference? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill set out to find out.
I swear, it feels like every time I go shopping, the cost of my groceries inches up. And it's not just my imagination. The U.S. expects the cost of food here to go up as much as 4% this year. I haven't yet had a moment at the grocery store where the cost of chicken breast or romaine lettuce made me reconsider my dinner plans. But that's not the case in some markets around the world. For more, we now turn to foreign news correspondents. First, we have a report from Tinku Ray in India.
Here at the INA market in Delhi, onions are selling at double the normal price, at around $1 a kilo. As the most common ingredient in Indian cooking, this is a good indicator of how expensive food is here.
Now reporter Brian Burns in Argentina.
At this market, the butchers say prices have already risen 40% in 2011, severely cutting domestic consumption of Argentina's tasty beef.
Okay, that's enough. So we've got a vaguely annoyed American shopper, frustrated vegetarians in India, hungry carnivores in Argentina, food price hikes in some parts of Africa contributing to riots. What's clear is that the cost of food is rising globally as more people with more money are looking to eat, well, more. But why is the rate of inflation for food so different from country to country? For one,
people in developing countries are buying primarily the raw product, the food.
Per Pinstrup Anderson is a professor at Cornell University.
Whereas we in the United States and Europe are buying primarily what is added, the value added after the food leaves the farm.
Think about the difference between a bowl of cornflakes and a handmade corn tortilla.
If you go and buy a bag of cornflakes, the proportion of what you pay that actually goes to the corn producer is extremely small.
You're paying a little for corn, and the rest for the person who makes the cereal, packages the cereal, sells the cereal, and prints that fancy rooster on the box. That corn tortilla, well, that just requires corn. So when the cost of corn goes up, the cost of making a tortilla will go up a lot faster than a box of cornflakes. But that's not the only reason food price inflation varies so much.
All countries just have kind of different exposure.
Derek Hetty is with the International Food Policy Research Institute.
So some countries import food, some countries export food, and other countries are basically self-sufficient in food and don't really participate much in international markets.
So take one of the world's largest rice importers, the Philippines. If international rice prices go up, the country basically has to import inflation. A country that grows and eats its own rice is immune to price jumps, as long as it gets good weather. And there are other big reasons food inflation is so different from country to country, like government policy. Fiscal stimulus plans, for example, can spur inflation, pushing up food prices. Again, Derek Hetty.
Food is one of those things that just responds very quickly because everybody has to eat.
And that's really the rub with rising food costs. If you want to live, you've got to eat. And what you'll pay for your food has a lot to do with where you are in the world. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, if you're looking for a sure way to alienate your neighbors, you could consider this offer from a fledgling advertising firm based here in Southern California. Adzuki could pay your mortgage for up to a year if only you'll agree to have your home painted as a massive billboard. Don't laugh. CEO Romeo Mendoza tells us just a day into the offer, there are up to 3,000 applications, including one from a church. Here's the deal. If you're really interested in this story, go to our website, marketplace.org, for the link and a mock-up picture of what the firm says a typical house painting could look like. Just don't confuse this with an endorsement. Made me kind of put off by the idea. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 32 points, or 0.25%. The NASDAQ added 8 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 rose 2 points. That's 0.2%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, Gaddafi. He used to be a hero fighting for the rights of small oil-producing countries.
All what happened in OPEC took place thanks to what Gaddafi did. Gaddafi started the whole process of change.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us back here for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.